This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Serhii Plokhii, Professor Serhii Plokhii of Harvard University. His new book is Nuclear Folly, A History of the Cuban Missile Crisis. It is Saturday, October 27th. Black Saturday, it's infamously called. There are two events that bring both sides to the level of we're going to shoot, they're going to shoot, we're going to shoot. I tell the first one because it happens in the Sargasso Sea. It's almost like a melodrama that has no ending. A U.S. flotilla has been following one, if not all, of the Russian submarine flotilla, Foxtrots. These are diesel-powered submarines, not nuclear. This is early days for nuclear submarines for the Soviet fleet. One of those, B-59, must surface to restore its battery power at some point. And when they do surface, they realize they've been tracked very carefully by the U.S. Navy. The USS Coney is following them. And at the same time, directions have been given from XCOM to harass the Soviet submarines. If you find them, harass them, use overflights, buzz them, drop flares, and even given orders to the fleet that they can drop dummy depth charges. All of this can be misunderstood, is misunderstood by B-59. What we do not at this point understand in the U.S. Navy is that that B-59 has a nuclear-tipped submarine, a torpedo, in its forward tubes. Professor, the events of B-59 are too fantastic to believe. This is one of those things where you can't make this stuff up. It had to be history. Who is the commander of the flotilla? Who is the commander of B-59? And what do they make of the USS Coney's threats?
Well, we are talking about October 27, 1962, and I would call it probably the second birthday of the world, because really the nuclear war could start on a number of occasions during that Saturday day, and the fact that it didn't start, it's really, really, we all got lucky, because the crisis, the managing of the crisis got out of the hands of the people at the top, in Kennedy in Washington and Khrushchev in Moscow, and was now in the hands of either commanders of the submarine or the pilots of the U-2 airplanes. With the submarine, it's an interesting situation that B-59 has actually, in fact, two commanders when it is supposed to have one. One is Captain Savitsky, who is the commander, the captain and commander of the submarine itself. And another is Captain Vasily Arkhipov, who is the commander of the entire task group of submarines, all four of them. And when they resurfaced to recharge their batteries, both Savitsky and Arkhipov were on the basically on the submarine's at the top of it, so that they were above the surface, together with a signalman, and they were communicating with the American ships at that time. When a reconnaissance plane showed up, it's in the middle of the night, and started dropping flares to get a better picture of the Soviet submarine. And Savitsky and Arkhipov and others who are on the bridge of the submarine, they think that they're under attack. So they rush down the hatch. First goes Savitsky and gives the order to prepare to fire not just any torpedo, but the nuclear-armed torpedo. Second goes the signalman with a searchlight and gets stuck in the hatch, can't get through. So Arkhipov is still on the bridge, and he sees that the American signalman is signaling apologies, that it wasn't an attack. So he then really overrules Savitsky and aborts the order to prepare to fire the nuclear submarine. And really, you can't make this stuff up.
That submarine, the professor gives us some statistics about what that submarine had on board. That nuclear-tipped submarine, 10 kilotons, would have destroyed the USS Coney, of course, but it could have sent a wave as high as 94 feet over all of the flotilla, would have destroyed everything all at once. And at that point, there would have been very little choice on the part of the United States to regard this as an attack on the U.S., United States, and nuclear weapons would have been free, not only in the Soviet Union and in the United States, but also in Cuba, because those missiles in Cuba are armed and ready to go. Now we go to Cuba, because on the there are U-2 flights being approved to see if the Soviets are moving their missiles or deploying more. And Pliyev is ill. The commander, overall commander, is ill. So the missile commander and his subordinates are in charge of defending themselves. The professor makes a very convincing presentation. They believe the overflights were preparation for bombing raids and then invasion. They believed they were going to die, and they were going to go down fighting. The explanation for why they fired on the U-2 is entirely human, Professor. I liked it. They believed they were defending their fatherland, their motherland, their parents. They understood that they had been sacrificed at the tip of the spear. They were honorable men. There's no villainy here, but my goodness, we came close.
Yes, indeed. And I write about the lieutenant, young lieutenant, who pulled the trigger, so to say, shooting down the American U-2, killing the pilot, Major Anderson. And he gets out of the cabin where he was doing that, and they celebrate, but they celebrate for a really very short time because they believe that they're already in war, and that the American strike is coming exactly on their positions, on the positions of this surface to air missiles. But again, the decision to shoot down the U-2 airplane comes after one night, sleepless night for the Soviet military, when they believed that the Americans were coming, that the invasion was coming. And they got this idea because Fidel Castro panicked. He got raw intelligence information from New York, from the headquarters of the United Nations. He put his troops on the alert. He gave an order to start shooting at the airplanes. Of course, Cubans actually could not reach U-2 airplanes. But that created an atmosphere in which Pliyev and others believed that the war already started, that the invasion is coming. And those were the commanders who went through the Second World War and who put to use their experience. They knew if there is a reconnaissance airplane there, like U-2, the next come the bombers and they're done. So their solution was to shoot down airplanes so that it would not bring back to Washington, would not bring back to the United States the photos of their positions of their missiles. So again, it's as you said, on the one hand, you restore this logic, you can understand what is happening, but in reality, the crisis was not by that moment already not just a crisis, a diplomatic crisis. It turned into potentially in the shooting war. It was up to Kennedy to respond, how to treat that. The American plane is down over Cuba.
The crisis at hand passes accidentally. It's all accident. There's no good information flowing to Washington or to Moscow. The men in the field, both in the Sargasso Sea and in Cuba, and the U.S. Air Force, do not have fresh information. They're going on the basis of their orders. That they do not pull the trigger is a miracle. However, just because Washington and Moscow will now learn that the crisis is past, that they found a way out of this, there is going to be a major block to settling this. That is, how can the Americans know that the Soviets have actually pulled their missiles back? Who's going to validate that? And who's going to deal with Fidel Castro when we come back? The book is Nuclear Folly, A History of the Cuban Missile Crisis. Serhiy Plokhii is the author. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.